This is the Nuance Podcast by Medicine Explained. We're your hosts, Amanda
and Dan.
We talk to experts on health, the human experience, and the intersection of climate and human health.
We explore the nuance that's been lost in today's conversation. We don't take ads because we want to keep our information unbiased.
But we do need your support. So leave a review on Apple or Spotify.
And share with your friends or on social media.
In today's conversation, we have the opportunity to speak with Dr. Christopher Palmer, who is a Harvard Medical School physician, researcher, consultant, and educator, dedicated to improving the lives of people suffering from mental illness. He is working at the interface of metabolism, metabolic disorders, and what we call mental disorders. Although most people don't think these are related, there is a tremendous amount of scientific evidence linking these. He has extensive experience and expertise in psychopharmacology, psychotherapy, and complementary and alternative treatments for psychiatric disorders. Dr. Palmer received his medical degree from Washington University School of Medicine. He did his internship and psychiatry residency at McLean Hospital, Massachusetts General Hospital, and Harvard Medical School. He is currently the director of the Department of Postgraduate and Continuing Education at McLean Hospital and an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. In this conversation, Dr. Palmer explains what metabolic health is and how it relates to mental health. He shares his experience in helping symptoms of psychiatric conditions with treating metabolic health. He talks about the importance of mitochondria. This conversation is important for everyone, with or without a diagnosed mental health disease. He offers advice on how to stay metabolically healthy and help mood, as well as how a ketogenic diet could help patients with psychiatric diagnoses. He also has a new book coming out called Brain Energy, a revolutionary breakthrough in understanding mental health and improving treatment for anxiety, depression, OCD, PTSD, and more. This was an amazing conversation, and we hope you enjoy it. Now, on to the podcast. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited to have you here. I heard you featured on other podcasts, and I just loved what you were talking about. It's so fascinating. So thank you for coming onto our podcast to help educate our listeners and me.
Thank you, Amanda. Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. So I would love to just jump right into it. So you talk about metabolic health and mental illness. What is metabolic health? What is insulin resistance?
You know, it's a really important question. And I am going to give a complicated answer to that, unfortunately, for better or worse. So there are people who will say those two terms are synonymous, that metabolic health and insulin sensitivity or a lack of insulin resistance are synonymous. And it's actually not quite so simple. Insulin resistance, I can start with that one because that's easy. It's not the big picture one. The insulin resistance basically means that the insulin signaling system in the body is not working properly. And that has importance for many reasons, but the primary reason is because insulin is involved with glucose utilization in many different parts of the body. And in order for glucose to be used as a fuel source for most cells, insulin is kind of, a lot of people talk about it as a lock and key. Insulin allows glucose to get inside a cell. And so if insulin signaling is impaired, it means that possibly enough glucose is not getting into those cells. And then those cells can become energy deprived. And when a cell is energy deprived, it's not going to work properly. The story with insulin is actually even more complicated than that, though, because insulin receptors are located throughout the human brain. And what insulin is doing in the human brain is not quite the same thing that it's doing in the body. There are many brain cells, neurons in particular, that glucose can get into quite easily. with or without insulin. And yet insulin is playing a significant role in energy production in those cells. And insulin is playing a role in the function of mitochondria. So some people are thinking about insulin in the brain more as almost like a neurotransmitter or something that is modulating brain activity. And it's more complicated than just the letting glucose get into a cell, but it's related to energy production and mitochondria. So that's insulin. And that was, I just gave a more complicated answer than most people give, unfortunately.
No, that's super fascinating because I had never heard that it phrased as a neuromodulator.
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's interesting because, you know, we've known, so researchers have known that insulin receptors are located in the brain for many, many decades. But up until about 20 years ago, they kind of ignored it. They ignored that fact and they didn't really think much of it. Because they knew that glucose could be used as a fuel source by the brain no matter what. Because without fuel, the brain would die, neurons would die, and then we would die. So they didn't think that it was really playing much of a role, even though they knew those receptors were there. Well, you know, there's this thing in biology that if something's there, it's probably there for a reason, and it's probably serving some useful purpose. So that field of research has actually exploded in the last 20 years. But the real answer is there's so much we still don't know about it. Researchers are still trying to figure out and understand exactly what role is insulin playing in the human brain. There's actually a fair amount of research that suggests the insulin is probably being produced in the brain itself and that it's not coming from the pancreas. So the story gets really complicated really fast, and there are a lot of unanswered questions. But your first question, like what is metabolic health? That one is extraordinarily difficult to answer in reality. And the reason I say that is because metabolism is kind of part of the definition of life. It's part of the definition of a living organism. And so a simple definition of metabolism from my stance would be it's a process of turning food into energy or building blocks that get used to maintain or grow cells. And then metabolism also involves the management of waste products. So energy, building blocks, waste products. Those are the three main components of metabolism. If there's a problem in any of those areas, by definition, we would call that a metabolic problem. And essentially what that means is that a metabolic problem, in my mind, is a problem with energy production or a problem with building blocks to maintain or grow cells, or a problem with waste management. Waste molecules might be building up and can become toxic, and that could even be a metabolic problem. So in fact, there are, you know, in the medical field, there are these things called inborn errors of metabolism, which are very rare genetic defects. They can cause all sorts of problems in any different steps of those pathways. You know, there are vitamin deficiencies and hormone deficiencies that can cause metabolic problems. So I guess I would put it there if that's a helpful answer. I don't know.
That is very helpful. And I think that there's like a crazy statistic of about like 92.3% of the United States is metabolically unhealthy. So of course, like I read that headline and I'm like, okay, well, what makes up metabolic health? So thank you for explaining that.
Well, and so, no, so that question is actually more easily answered. And that usually they're talking about people who have no components of metabolic syndrome. Mm. So metabolic syndrome is composed of five different things: high blood pressure, abdominal obesity, insulin resistance, high triglycerides, and low HDL cholesterol. And if you have three or more of those five criteria, you have what's called metabolic syndrome. And that means you're at much higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease. And you're probably on your way to obesity if you're not already obese. So the, you know, I think a lot of those population surveys that talk about, you know, only 8% or so of the population is metabolically healthy is really looking at those five metrics and looking at how many people have none of those. And sadly, yeah, it's like 8% of the population. It's getting worse every year.
So using your definition of metabolic health, what percentage of the population do you think is metabolically healthy? More or less?
If we're talking about an extreme ideal health, definitely less, because there are so many metrics of metabolic health, and those five metrics, while very good metrics, I'm not here to bash them or diminish their value, because I think they are very valuable. You know, insulin resistance that we measure in the vein of somebody by taking a blood sample is not the same thing as insulin resistance or insulin signaling problems in the brain. We know with certainty that people can actually have normal, what appears to be normal insulin signaling in the periphery or in your vein, but they, by brain scans, we can tell that they have glucose hypometabolism in their brain, which means that their brain cells are actually energy deprived because they're not getting enough ATP from glucose. And what that means is that those cells become very compromised and they begin to malfunction. And glucose hypometabolism has been found in many disorders like Alzheimer's disease, many psychiatric disorders, but even something like alcoholism. We have found glucose hypometabolism. And so so those five metrics of metabolic syndrome may or may not tell you much about what's happening in other parts of the body.
Wow, that's fascinating. So let's jump into your work. So how does your work relate to metabolism, and what's your background, and how did you choose to study the ketogenic diet?
So it's actually all a story of serendipity. The quick version, and I'll just fly through the early part. So the early part is that when I was in my 20s, I actually already was suffering from metabolic syndrome. And I was really disheartened because I was doing everything supposedly right. I was following a very low-fat diet, and I was exercising pretty regularly. Some could say I was stressed because I was doing my residency, internship and residency. But I already had metabolic syndrome, and I was really actually quite worried because I was treating patients in the hospital every day, seeing them with heart attacks and strokes and complications of diabetes and everything else. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm only in my 20s. And like, I'm probably going to have a heart attack when I'm 40 or 50 if I keep up at this rate. This is not good. My doctor kept telling me I needed to do diet and exercise. He kept recommending the same low-fat diet that I was doing already and the same exercise that I was doing already. So that was getting me nowhere. And then he finally started trying to push pills on me. And I said, you know what? Give me 3 months. I'm going to try this little thing called the Atkins diet, which was complete heresy. It went against everything I had been taught as a physician. And I honestly, in my heart of hearts, did not think it was going to work. But I had heard from other people that it can help diabetes. It can help improve cholesterol levels, even though people are eating eggs every morning. I was just frustrated and realized that the next step is for me to have a heart attack when I'm 40 or 50, because I know the pills this doctor is going to give me are not going to prevent that, I'm on my way to a heart attack, and that's really not okay. So I went on a low carbohydrate diet, and 3 months later, everything got better. So my metabolic syndrome essentially went away. Every aspect of my metabolic syndrome went away. And that was my goal. But I noticed a side effect. And the side effect was that my mood was dramatically better. And I had so much more energy, and I had more confidence. My sleep was dramatically better. And I was waking up feeling refreshed. And that hadn't happened. Like, I was one of those people who pushed the snooze button like multiple times every morning. And I had it timed to the minute about when do I absolutely have to drag my butt out of bed in order to get to work on time. And I became somebody who started waking up early before my alarm went off, and I felt great. And I had never been that way. And so I had friends and family doing this diet, and they too were noticing a similar effect, that their mood was getting better. They had more energy. They felt great. And so, you know, it took me a few years, but within a few years, I started using it in patients with treatment-resistant depression who had exhausted all of their other options. They had already tried dozens of antidepressants, mood stabilizers, and other medicines. Some of them had already had shock treatments. Most of them had been in decades of psychotherapy, and nothing was working. They had treatment-resistant depression and were disabled by their illness. And so I was like, well, what do we have to lose? Like, it had a really powerful antidepressant effect on me, but I was kind of okay. I didn't have treatment-resistant depression or anything, but like, what do we have to lose? Maybe this could help you. And so several of them tried it, and lo and behold, it had dramatic and powerful effects in some of those patients. At that point, you know, it was such a controversial diet, and we did not have much published in the academic literature, that I wasn't willing to really talk about it or publish anything on it. But I kept using it in clinical practice and, you know, in patients with treatment-resistant depression. And, you know, everything changed for me in 2016 when I had a patient with schizoaffective disorder, which is kind of a cross between schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. He asked for my help to lose weight. So this man weighed 340 pounds. He had hallucinations and delusions every day of his life. He was tormented by his illness. He had already tried 17 different medications. They didn't work to stop his symptoms. He was absolutely disabled by his illness. He could barely leave home. And when he asked for my help to lose weight, I was kind of like, well, you know, you're taking some initiative to improve your health. Like, yeah, absolutely, I'll support that. I had no concept that this was going to help his symptoms, even though I was using it as an antidepressant in people. I kind of thought, well, depression and schizoaffective disorder are totally different disorders. Like, they have nothing to do with each other. So I went ahead, but I was like, but it'll help him lose weight. I know how to do it, and it'll help him lose weight. So I helped him lose weight. Within about 2 weeks, I noticed this powerful antidepressant effect in him. And I thought, that's really striking, because I've never seen him so happy. He's making better eye contact. He's smiling. He's talking. This is really striking, but, you know, I guess I've seen this before. It's an antidepressant effect. The shocking thing to me was within about 6 to 8 weeks, he spontaneously started telling me, you know, those voices that I hear all the time? I'm like, yeah. It's like, they're going away. And within a couple more weeks, he said, you know how I always thought that there were these powerful families who were controlling me and tormenting me, and they could control my thoughts, and they targeted me, and they were after me? And I'm like, yeah, I know. And he said, I don't think that's happening anymore. And now that I think about it, maybe it never was. It sounds kind of crazy now that I say it. And so that man went on to lose 150 pounds. He's kept it off to this day. He's actually lost like another 10 or 15 pounds now. So he's down 160 plus pounds. He was able to move out of his father's home. He was able to perform improv in front of a live audience. And this was a man who couldn't go out in public. He was terrified of going out in public. And that completely upended everything that I knew as a psychiatrist. Because I was like, this can't be happening. This is impossible. A diet is putting schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder into what seems pretty close to remission. It never went fully into full remission for him, but it got pretty close at one point. And I was dumbfounded. I started searching the medical literature to understand. So I knew the ketogenic diet as a weight loss diet, and I also knew that it was being used in diabetes. At the time, I didn't know it was an evidence-based treatment for epilepsy. But I quickly learned that, oh, this is a treatment for epilepsy and has been around for 100 years. And that, you know, lit a light bulb in my head with like, wait, we use epilepsy treatments all the time in psychiatry. If this diet stops seizures, maybe that's, it's doing something just as powerful to his brain, but it's stopping his psychotic symptoms. Oh my God, this is like phenomenal. So I started using the diet in other patients. It was not across the board effective for every patient. I will say that and be clear about that. So this is not a miracle treatment for, not a one size fits all treatment for every human being with a mental illness. I will say that. But it did have equally effective and sometimes more effective. Some patients got into full remission, got off all their meds. And so I started publishing case reports. I started collaborating with researchers around the world. I started doing more of a deep dive into the science of the ketogenic diet and how on earth can a diet put a chronic mental disorder into full and complete remission. And that really led to kind of a whole second career for me.
Wow. That is amazing. I did my sub-I, so my acting internship in medical school, my fourth year medical school in psychiatry. And one of the things that frustrated me about the field is that I feel like medications haven't really changed that much in decades, and I wasn't reversing anyone's illnesses. And so this is so exciting to have, even if it doesn't work for every single patient, to have something that even just for one person can reverse or even help the symptoms. That's amazing. Because also some of the psychiatric drugs that we prescribe have pretty severe side effects. So if we can have the side effect of like losing weight and also helping your metabolic issues along with your psychiatric issues, that's huge.
I felt exactly the same way. So I've been a psychiatrist for over 25 years. And, you know, I will say up until the last 6 years, I was always just horribly, deeply saddened whenever I saw a patient with a psychotic disorder, because our treatments are abysmal. It is rare for patients to get better enough to even function in the world. Almost all of them are disabled. Most of them are suffering horribly. And our medications are giving them all the side effects that you mentioned. They're making them gain weight and become diabetic and develop premature cardiovascular disease and die early deaths. And we know that that's happening. I'm not being anti-medication by saying that. It's on the package inserts. If you read the FDA package inserts, it's right there listed. But, you know, even with those side effects, if they healed people's brains, I'd be all for it. I would just say, well, it's kind of like cancer and chemotherapy. Like it's a horrible side effect, but at least it's saving a life and restoring health. But unfortunately, our current treatments fail to restore mental health. Actually, the sad statistic is in the majority of people, more than 50% of people who seek the help of a psychiatrist do not get better from their mental disorder. And that's across the board and across diagnostic categories, tragically. That includes major depression, bread and butter, simple depression. So most people think that, you know, something like depression, well, that's an easy diagnosis. Like we dole out antidepressants all the time. We've got dozens and dozens to choose from. We have psychotherapy. We've got all sorts of other medications we can use. We've got shock treatments if it's really bad. We have so many treatments for depression. People must be getting better, right? Wrong. The statistics are that depression is now the leading cause of disability on planet Earth. It is the leading cause of disability even in the United States, even though we have all of those treatments available. They aren't working for all of these people. For millions and millions of people, these treatments are not working. And when you look at any of the longitudinal studies, and there have been many, numerous longitudinal studies, some of them huge studies like the STAR-D trial, which looked at how effective are our treatments for depression. The answer was not very effective. Maybe 30-something percent will get a remission. That means 70% don't get a remission. And then we keep trying drug after drug after drug. And the more drugs you try, the less likely they are to get a remission. Other studies have followed people with depression for, for sometimes 12 years. One study that I cite in a book that I'm coming out with soon, 12 years. And these are patients who are all being treated at academic medical centers. So presumably they're getting the standard of care and some of the best of care possible. 90% of them, 90%, continued to have symptoms of depression on and off over those 12 years. And what that means is that the treatments that we're using, these patients were getting whatever treatment the clinician wanted to offer. So that includes medications and or psychotherapy. The treatments we were delivering to them were not putting their depression into full and complete remission over long periods of time. 90% of people were not cured or even put into remission their illness. And so increasingly, mental disorders are chronic disorders. It's not that treatments don't work. It's not that I'm saying people shouldn't get treatment, because treatment can help. It can reduce suffering. It can save people's lives when we help people through a suicidal crisis. It can sometimes put symptoms into remission, but more often than not, within a few years, it comes back. It's not like it goes into remission and stays in remission for the rest of the person's life. The statistics don't suggest that at all. What they suggest is that somebody would be lucky if they got a remission for 1 or 2 years. And then something stressful would happen in life and the symptoms would come back, and we would call that medication poop out, where, oh, the medication stopped working. We're not really sure what happened. And then we start trying medication after medication. And so this area of inquiry, using a diet that can put symptoms into full and complete remission for long periods of time, is extraordinarily exciting. And I have to say, as a psychiatrist, extraordinarily rewarding.
That's amazing. And I think there's just more and more awareness about the fact that, especially with mental health issues on the rise, that we need other options for treatment besides medication. Because medication can be beneficial for some people, like you were saying, but sometimes you just have to supplement it with other lifestyle factors. Your research and your work is so exciting. So why do you think it works?
So the really great news on that front is that because this is an evidence-based treatment in neurology for epilepsy, we have decades of neuroscience research on this intervention. And so the ketogenic diet does numerous things. It changes neurotransmitter levels. It might be correcting that chemical imbalance that everybody talks about. It changes hormone levels and hormone signaling, including insulin and insulin resistance. It improves insulin resistance. It changes ion channel signaling. So calcium channels in particular are known to play a role in the function of basically most human cells, but certainly also in psychiatric disorders, and this normalizes that. It decreases brain inflammation. It changes the gut microbiome. It actually changes gene expression in a wide variety of cell types. And so it does all of those things. I will tell you that, so I have this book coming out. I'm going to put in a shameless plug for it, Brain Energy. And in that book, I am presenting a unifying theory of what causes mental illness. And I am arguing that all mental disorders are metabolic disorders of the brain. In order to understand metabolism at the cellular level, you actually have to understand mitochondria. And once you understand everything that mitochondria do, you can actually start to put together the pieces of the puzzle of mental illness. We can put together all of the risk factors for mental illness and start to make sense of it. But one of the reason that I digressed and said that is because one of the things that this diet does, the ketogenic diet, is it results in two processes, one that's called mitophagy and another that's called mitochondrial biogenesis. And what those mean, mitophagy means healing and repairing mitochondria. It means getting rid of old defective mitochondria and replacing them with new ones. But mitochondrial biogenesis is basically making more mitochondria for your cells. And so when people do this diet, they get both. And so what it means is that their cells at the end of this diet, like after a year or two of doing this diet, their cells have more mitochondria and those mitochondria are healthier. And I have lots of reason to believe that that can have extraordinarily powerful healing effects in people with mental disorders.
Wow. I've been saying that a lot in this conversation, but this is all very interesting and mind-blowing and very on the front edge of and scientific research. So it's really exciting. I was actually talking to my partner, Daniel, who's an intern in psychiatry. And a couple of years ago, I read a book on mitochondria. And I was like, mitochondria is going to be like the big new thing that we're going to do more research on. Because like we're starting to see that statins affect mitochondria, which is one of the bad side effects. And we're starting to think about that a little bit more. And then like you were saying, mitochondrial health is so important for mental health. And I mean, mitochondria is like the powerhouse of the cell, we've all been taught. So it's everywhere in the body. It matters a lot.
It really, so that's one of the things that I really cover in the book is all of the different roles that mitochondria play. So there is no question mitochondria are the powerhouse of the cell. But I think one of the points that I make in my book and that many researchers who are mitochondrial researchers really, we want to get rid of that term because it's too simplistic. Mitochondria are so much more than powerhouses. And one mitochondrial researcher, I love this analogy. He said, if you think of a cell, a human cell as a computer, mitochondria are not only the power cord for that computer, but they are also the motherboard for that computer. They are doing both. They are providing the power and they are the motherboard. They are allocating resources. They are directing traffic. They are deciding like what exactly is going to happen in that cell, when, where, and how. And if they become dysfunctional, cells become dysfunctional. And it can result in a whole host of human illnesses.
Wow. So we were talking about mitochondrial health. And something that I was thinking about when you were mentioning metabolic syndrome and how mitochondria is also linked with mental health. And I was wondering if you see higher rates of like treatment-resistant depression and schizophrenia in countries and places with higher levels of metabolic syndrome.
Yes, we do. So that has largely been, that's actually been known for centuries. So, you know, for centuries, we've noticed that when countries westernize, that they develop these illnesses of affluence. Sometimes that's what they're called, illnesses of affluence. And it usually was referred to as obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, and cancer. That those were all diseases of affluence. And it turns out mental disorders are also diseases of affluence. And so those illnesses, we've actually known since the 1800s, researchers talked about the fact that diabetes tends to run in the exact same families as insanity, is what they called it then, and vice versa. Insanity runs in families that have high rates of diabetes. And so we know it from population. So we know it from, you know, the Chinese population in particular. They had very low rates of diabetes, metabolic syndrome, and mental illness prior to, you know, maybe 30 years ago. I don't know when the inflection point was. But as China began to westernize, rates of everything, including mental illness, started skyrocketing. So at the same time that rates of diabetes and obesity skyrocket, rates of mental disorders start skyrocketing. A lot of people think that, you know, the rates of schizophrenia are very low and consistent and that they are not increasing. So that is the one diagnosis that's most debatable. However, there's another chronic psychotic disorder called bipolar disorder. And clinicians often struggle with like, which one is it? Because we often can't tell when somebody comes in with their first psychotic episode, we actually don't know what they have. Their very first psychotic episode, you can't diagnose schizophrenia until they've been psychotic for at least 6 months. Oftentimes, they look like they might have a mood disorder. So it might be bipolar disorder, but it might be psychotic depression. Could be due to drugs and alcohol. Like, we just don't know for sure. And they all look the same. They look identical. You can't tell them apart. And but anyway, bipolar disorder has been skyrocketing in prevalence since the 1960s in the United States. So in the 1960s and 70s, the prevalence of bipolar disorder in the United States was largely thought to be like 0.6 to like 1.4%. Now it's on the order of like 5 to 8%. So, I mean, that's an exponential increase. Even though it's only 5 to 8%, it is an exponential increase in the rates. When we look at the younger generation, the rates of serious mental illness in the last 20 years have doubled in the young population. And again, a lot of people are grappling to try to understand why. Why are mental illnesses spiraling out of control? And I just want to point out the obvious. Rates of diabetes and obesity are spiraling out of control. And that is not a coincidence, people. It is not a coincidence. At the same time that rates of diabetes and obesity are skyrocketing, rates of mental illness, if you understand the biology and if you understand the neuroscience, we should know and expect that rates of mental illness will continue to skyrocket until we get metabolic health under control.
And so how does the ketogenic diet work and how does it help with brain metabolism?
So the ketogenic diet is doing lots of things. I think that, you know, there were all the mechanisms of action that I kind of described earlier, neurotransmitters, decreasing inflammation, all that stuff. In terms of improving brain metabolism, the easiest answer to that is mitochondria. The ketogenic diet stimulates mitophagy and mitochondrial biogenesis. So it stimulates the repair of mitochondria and it stimulates the production of new mitochondria. And once you have more mitochondria in your cell, the cell has a higher metabolic capacity. It has more metabolic flexibility, meaning that it can survive periods without food. It can manage excess food more appropriately, and it can just function better. And there are lots of other mechanisms of action. You know, it decreases insulin resistance. It does all sorts of other things. It changes the gut microbiome, which probably is playing a role. So it's doing a lot of things. But based on everything that I know, and the easiest way to connect all of the dots together is you've got to focus on mitochondria.
Thank you. That's very well explained. So you also wrote an article called 6 Steps to Stop an Addiction to Sugar and Junk Food. I think that the next step from understanding that a ketogenic diet can really help our mental health, and I would love for you to explain like what kind of diet you recommend for everyone, because some people aren't in treatment resistant depression or have schizoaffective disorder. So what's your general advice to your patients or to the general population? And then how do we make that transition? How can we get away from these sugars and this junk food that is constantly at our fingertips?
two very important questions. So, you know, my general advice of what is the right diet for every human being on the planet who is healthy, I don't have one and only one recommendation. I just want to be clear about that. Humans in different cultures have often eaten different diets, and they have done quite well eating different diets. So we just need to be mindful of that. And I know that, you know, there are all sorts of diet gurus who will say everybody should eat a vegan diet, and then we would have 100% healthy people. If everybody ate a, you know, ketogenic diet, then we'd have 100% healthy people. No, I personally don't believe that that is necessary. What I would say, however, is, you know, so some of it depends on who you are as a human being and who you want to be as a human being. If you want to be a competitive athlete and you need large muscles for that, you do need to think more about protein and other types of macronutrients, because some diets that restrict protein, for instance, you're not going to be a big muscle person if you are restricting protein. You're just not. If that's fine with you, that may be a perfectly fine diet for you. But so some of it depends on the person and what their goals are and, you know, what they need to do to function in the world. But as a rule of thumb, I would say the more you can eat real whole foods, the better. So try to focus on foods that you know where it came from. It's a whole entire food. You could pick it from the ground or get it off a tree, or if it's an animal, you would know where it came from, or fish or whatever, but you know what it is, you know where it came from. It didn't have to go to some factory to have 20 ingredients combined together and baked and cooked in order to make it. Because as soon as we start talking about processed and ultra-processed foods, there are lots of concerns about the different chemicals that they're adding. Most of them have not been tested for safety in humans. The only safety test they get is, like, do they mutate your DNA to cause cancer? That's about it. And if they don't mutate your DNA to cause cancer, well, then they must be healthy. Well, you know, come on. There's more to human health than mutating DNA. And we have strong reason to believe that a lot of these kind of chemicals and process things are adversely affecting human metabolism, the gut microbiome, which plays its own role in human metabolism. They're adversely affecting our hormones. There are all sorts of things. So the more you can stick with real food, whole food, the better. In terms of should everybody do a ketogenic diet even, I would say no. There are many ways to improve metabolic health. The ketogenic diet is a very powerful intervention, though, I will say. If I've got somebody with psychosis, it is definitely on my short list of interventions to consider. Is it the absolute only intervention? No. There are other ways to improve health. You know, I know of at least one man who overcame years of schizophrenia through exercise, apparently. But it wasn't walking around the block. He became a marathon runner. He had to really do extreme exercise.
That's amazing that he was motivated to do that. Wow.
Yes. But it worked for him. And again, you know, based on this kind of metabolic theory of mental illness, there's clear biological reason to understand how and why that would happen, because exercise also repairs mitochondria and increases the production of mitochondria in your cells. And so it improves your metabolic health, and that can improve brain function and restore normal brain function for some people.
Wow. And so how do we avoid the sugar and junk food as well?
The sugar and junk food. So, you know, I think that is going to be highly variable. And it depends on the person and it depends on their circumstances. Are they living with other people? So question number one is, do you live with other people and do they, you know, they're eating food as well? What are they eating? And are they willing to make some changes? So the first step in really overcoming any kind of addiction or craving, even if, you know, people in the psychiatry community do not like to call, don't really want to acknowledge that there's such a thing as food addiction. That's fine. We can just say people are not always in control of what they eat. if we say it that way, whether we call it addiction or not, then I would say, you know, when you're talking about trying to stop eating a food that you find as a comfort food, as a treat, the best way is to get it out of your, remove access to it. So get it out of your kitchen, get it out of your home. And the reason I say that is because everybody gets stressed. Everybody has weak moments. And you can have the best of intentions that I'm going to do this diet and I'm going to get rid of the processed foods in my life. And you can actually really mean it and you can really intend to adhere to it. But guess what? If you have that really nightmarish call in the hospital doing your residency and then you come home, or you just have a really stressful day at work, or your partner berates you and, you know, is mean to you, or something bad happens to you, diet goes out the window at that point. Like it's the last thing anybody's thinking about. Nobody cares about adhering to healthy practices at that point in those moments. And so removing the food from your home is probably the most important step. And you can do it stepwise. You can do one step at a time. Just, you know, start to give, maybe start with, I'm not going to have dessert during the week. Or maybe instead of snacking on this snack, I'm going to snack on a different snack. But I'm going to encourage you, if you just do that, well, I'm going to buy some extra carrot sticks. And I'll snack on those instead of all the junk food that I'm always snacking on. But I'm going to keep the junk food because I am still going to have that in moderation. I can tell you now that's not going to work. That strategy is not going to work for you. And I'm not saying that to be mean. It's just not going to work. Very, very few people will have the capacity to do that. Instead, if you decide I'm going to snack on carrot sticks instead of chips, what I want you to do is stop buying the chips so that the chips are no longer in your home and only carrot sticks are in the home. And, you know, and then that might mean you're going to snack on something else. But if you do it stepwise like that, that can be helpful. If you find some partners in your kind of diet journey, that can be helpful. So, you know, if you've got a significant other, encourage that person to make these changes with you, or at least encourage that person to support you. Let them know, this is what I want to do. And so if you see me having a really stressful day and going for the bag of chips, please stop me. Or please at least just remind me. I know you've got a shitty day. I know you've had a really bad day. I'm sorry. Instead of the chips, come here. Let me give you a massage, or let me give you a big hug, or let me do something else. You don't need the chips right now. And so it's not that I want people to ignore their stress, because they can't ignore it. They need to take care of themselves and get some kind of a reward. But your partner could be a huge help in that. But your kids, your family, you know, friends, all sorts of people can play a role. For some people, gradual changes like that honestly don't work well. It's just too slow. It's too painful. It's like very, very slowly pulling off a Band-Aid. And so other people actually find that it's much easier just to set a date. Next Thursday, I'm starting. And they just start and they go cold turkey. They get rid of all the food that they do not want to be eating in their home. And they stock their home with foods that they do want to start eating. And they do it. And that can be really uncomfortable for the first week or two. It really is. And if, you know, people who say there's no such a thing as carbohydrate withdrawal don't have never done a low carb diet, because there absolutely is such a thing. And so you want to be prepared for that, and, you know, make sure you don't start a diet like that at a stressful time in your life or when you've got a big presentation or something.
Thank you so much for going through those recommendations. And I like that you have like two different takes on it as well, because like you said at the beginning, one size doesn't fit all. So a lot of times people need personalized advice. So I really appreciate that. I concurrently got my MPH along with my MD. And every time I think about diet, I mean, with the rise in mental health and the rise in obesity and diabetes, and then the recommendations we give, like make sure your environment is better for you to succeed in this diet journey. The amount of junk food and regulations on food that we have in the United States is absolutely insane. I grew up a little bit in Germany as well. And so like in Europe too, you just have fresher food and there's more regulations on what kind of food you get.
And that, you know, honestly, we don't have to go too much into it, but I have a friend who is from France. And he said that when he moved to the United States, he gained 20 pounds by eating the exact same food. And he actually thinks that it might be some of the pesticides or chemicals or processed kind of things that we allow in our food supply that the Europeans do not allow, that may be dysregulating the gut microbiome or hormones or other things that may be playing a role in metabolism. So it quickly gets confusing fast, unfortunately. It really does. Like, what do you need to do? But the good news is that we do have a lot of diets and dietary strategies that work for real people. And we've got clinical trials to show that they work. And low-carb and ketogenic diets are among them. They're not the only ones. But people who, you know, for anybody who hears, well, the keto diet, that's a fad diet. Don't do a fad diet. That's actually not at all true. If you believe in medical research, we actually have, I think, over 60 randomized controlled trials of the ketogenic diet for weight loss. And all of those trials across the board, all of them say, yes, the ketogenic diet is both effective and, guess what, safe. It is safe. People aren't dying of heart attacks doing a ketogenic diet. So we've got lots of dietary strategies, but a whole food plant-based diet works for some people, and they really like that, and that strategy works for them. So I'm all for whatever works and being pragmatic.
Thank you so much. And before the end of the hour, I just have one last question that we ask all of our guests. So we ask all of our guests to finish the following sentence: the future is blank.
So I would say the future is bright and hopeful for the millions of people who are suffering from mental illness, who are being told that they have a chronic lifelong disorder, and there's nothing more we can do for you. The future is filled with hope. And I hope you will check out my book, because it offers a lot of information for you.
Thank you, Dr. Palmer. We will link to your book in the bio. And I really appreciate this conversation. You do bring a lot of hope to this field, and in a field that needs a lot of hope. So I really, really do appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
The opinions expressed on this show are those of the Nuance and Medicine Explained and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of their places of employment. The opinions expressed on this podcast are meant for entertainment and education purposes only and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition, nor should they be used as a substitute for medical advice from a qualified board-certified practicing clinician.